Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is your Arrow News reporter with last-minute hit-the-spot news brought to you four times daily through the courtesy of Arrow Beer and Ale. With more than 100 brands of beer from which to choose, why does Washington select Arrow Beer as its outstanding favorite? Why is Arrow Beer making more new friends than any other brand? You'll understand why when you next taste Arrow. Arrow is smooth, not sweet. Better, not bitter. Arrow Beer always hits the spot. Reaction for and against President Roosevelt's neutrality policy is resounding in the halls of Congress and echoing overseas in the warring nations of Europe. The President has laid before an extraordinary session of Congress a proposal for repeal of the arms embargo provision of the Neutrality Act. And he has declared that the surest road to peace is to return the American nation to the principles of international law. Senate isolationists have answered with a promise to fight Mr. Roosevelt's program to the finish. 24 members of the isolationist bloc held a strategy meeting and pledged themselves to a vigorous stand against the president's policy, but they agreed not to resort to filibuster tactics. On the other side of the fence, Democratic leaders have banded together to push the administration's program. Senate Majority Leader Barkley says the Senate Democratic Steering and Policy Committees will meet at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning. They will attempt to limit the special session to consideration of the neutrality law proposals. This is in accordance with the President's wishes. Overseas, the British people have acclaimed Mr. Roosevelt's appeal for removal of the arms embargo. For to the British and French, such action by Congress would mean that they could arm their troops with American munitions. But sentiments are quite the opposite in Berlin. Nazi diplomatic quarters have welcomed the President's announced determination to keep America out of war. But Nazi leaders are bitterly critical of his demand for removal of the arms embargo. The Germans believe that the proposed cash-and-carry policy would work to the exclusive advantage of France and Great Britain. Incidentally, WJSV will carry a full broadcast of Mr. Roosevelt's speech tonight at 10:45. Ominous developments in the European war indicate that a major offensive may be launched on the Western Front at any moment. French forces are said to be driving further into Germany, while hordes of Nazi troops are moving up to meet their advance. At the same time, interest is centering on the smoldering Balkans after the assassination of Romania's premier, Arman Călinescu, by Nazi Iron Gardists. In the east, Soviet troops continue their march through eastern Poland, and it has been announced in Moscow that Polish peasant committees are redistributing Polish estates under orders of the Soviet military. The British Admiralty says reports that Great Britain has captured the German line of Bremen are absurd. This denial puts an end to the most recent stories as to the whereabouts of the $20 million German luxury ship. The Bremen has been unreported since leaving New York before the war began. The Admiralty announcement was accompanied by denials of several other rumors. The Ministry of Information says there is no foundation for reports of the loss of the British warships Hood, Renown, and Repulse. Back in this country, the United States destroyer Leary has steamed out on an undisclosed mission. Her crew on shore leave had been rounded up by Boston police prior to the hasty departure. Sailing orders were issued from Rear Admiral Tarrant's office of the Boston Navy Yard. It is understood that the Leary is fully equipped. There is to be no let-up in the federal investigation in Louisiana. Assistant Attorney General Roach, Chief of the Justice Department Criminal Division, has made that clear. Roach said that the inquiry will be carried on after all the cases now scheduled have been handled. And here's some news of local interest. Next year, 1940, is a leap year, but the Palace Theater is jumping the gun on New Year's by more than 3 months. At its midnight preview of the new picture, The Women, tonight, the fair sex of the moviegoers will be obliged to buy the tickets for their doubly fortunate male escorts. Listen in again for the Arrow News Reporter, brought to you by the Globe Brewing Company of Baltimore at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. And remember, when you order beer, be sure to ask for Arrow, the beer with the famous flavor. Hugh Conover speaking. This is Columbia Station for the nation's capital. The following announcement is electrically transcribed.
Here's the story of the 1940 cars in a nutshell.
Best bets, Buick.
See your nearest Buick dealer for complete details.
WJSV, Washington.
Listen. AMOCO. Amoco. With each ticking second, the history of the world is being rewritten. What's the news? And what does it mean? The American Oil Company, maker of the famous Amoco gas, Orange American gas, and Amoco Motor Oil, brings you the world-famous reporter Edwin C. Hill to tell you. And here is Mr. Hill.
Good evening, everyone. We hear from the national capital that President Roosevelt's neutrality program appears headed for a bitter battle in Congress when a powerful bipartisan bloc of 24 members agrees to fight the administration arms embargo repeal proposal, in the words of one of the senators, from hell to breakfast. The president declared before Congress today that the existing act, with its embargo on the sale of arms and implements of war, so alters the historic policy of the United States as to impair the peaceful relations of this country with foreign nations. He went on to say that neutrality, as he had reminded Congress, could not, in his opinion, be deliberately legislated. A neutrality law may actually give aid to an aggressor, he said, and deny it to the victim. Self-preservation, he said, should warn Americans against that. The present act, with its arms and munitions embargo, he told them, is not in accordance with historical and traditional American policy or with international law. It is, he said, a deviation by statute from the sound principles of neutrality and peace. I regret that the Congress passed that act. I regret equally that I signed that act, Mr. Roosevelt said. And then he requested repeal of the existing act as vitally dangerous to American neutrality, American security, and American peace. What will Hitler do now? Read that riddle and you'll have the answer to the question in 10 million times 10 million anxious hearts. Will he hurl his legions fresh from the swift conquest of Poland against the French and the British? Or, as he himself hints, will he stand pat and say, gentlemen, there's no more Poland to fight about. I don't want to fight you, French and British. If you'll keep the peace, I will. But if you insist on fighting, I'll give you plenty of it. It would seem, therefore, that the answer depends on the Allies. It would seem that this is what Hitler's aiming for, to put the democracies on the spot, to divert to them the onus of starting a world war. Now, if the answer does depend on the Allies, the decision as to whether they shall submit to the conquest and partition of Poland or whether they shall fight, then we must turn to the British government itself for enlightenment. Having already accused Herr Hitler of continuous mendacity, we find the British government in a white paper issued today again branding the German Chancellor with what Theodore Roosevelt used to call the short and ugly word. The white paper was issued to refute Hitler's assertion in his Danzig speech that Britain had rejected all peace proposals from Germany. This white paper, to which I refer, quoted the German government as not only refusing to adopt conditions of peace suggested by Britain, which were the withdrawal of German troops from Poland as a prerequisite to peace, but of even refusing to receive and accept those terms. Now, so far as the actual war news is concerned, there is little of major importance. Although we have reports tonight that there's been a revival of Polish resistance in various quarters, and although we know that Warsaw maintains a heroic resistance, comparable indeed to the defense which the loyalist government of Spain put up for 2 years in Madrid, we know, I say, that Polish hopes in a military sense have been, for an unpredictable time, extinguished. The Germans claim officially the capture of 105,000 Polish soldiers and virtually complete occupation of Poland along with the Russian allies. But what about those Russian allies? There comes a hint, not official, I must say, that the Russians are already overrunning the borders which were set in the agreement made at Brest-Litovsk. We know the simple fact that the Russians have thrown large bodies of troops between the German army and Romania, a move which cuts off the Germans, directly at least, from Romanian grain and oil. Now turning to the Western Front, we find that the French, with what must now amount to considerable British help, are standing guard a little in advance of the French Maginot Line, some 8 to 10 miles, it is stated. We hear also that the Allies are keeping a wary eye on the Dutch, Belgian, and Swiss frontiers in the fear that the Germans, attempting another one of their blitzkrieg strokes, will try to swing around the Maginot Line either by striking through Holland and Belgium or striking through Switzerland, the latter which might indeed be a tough job. We know that the advanced lines of the French and Germans have been for more than 2 weeks now in constant contact with each other, that there have been lively artillery duels and considerable air fighting. The casualties have run into thousands of killed and wounded. Nevertheless, warfare on the grand scale has not yet begun. Such French and American correspondents who've been permitted to glimpse the Western Front seem impressed with the completeness of the French mobilization. These observers report that all North and Eastern France are given over to military effort, that the civilian populations have been largely evacuated, and that everything from the French standpoint has been done to set up a redoubtable defense. The other item which erects itself in the news is the assassination which took place today of the Prime Minister of Romania. He was shot to death while he was driving in his armored car through the streets of Bucharest, the capital.
French news agencies reported the assassins to be members of the Romanian Iron Guard, the same organization which King Carol has labored to abolish and which is described to be the Romanian counterpart of the German Nazis. It is difficult to say what political implications this assassination may have. Romania is frankly at the mercy of Hitler and Stalin, with the Russians apparently the more likely to grab the prize, but apparently also interested in throwing a strong barrier of Soviet troops between Poland and Romania and his own Russian Rukane. Now, we have a word tonight, too, from Paris and the Prime Minister, the Premier of France, Premier Deladier. In a nationwide relief radio broadcast, Deladier declared that France will fight until Hitler is destroyed as French lines on the Western Front stiffen in anticipation of an unexpected Nazi mass offensive. As regards the Romanian assassination, it also comes in that 9 members of the masked band of pro-Nazi conspirators who assassinated the Premier Calinescu were taken to the scene of their crime and executed by a firing squad in the glare of anti-aircraft searchlights. Now, a word from my sponsor, the American Oil Company. Money can't buy a finer motor fuel than Amoco gas, but there are a lot of people I know who buy regular priced gasoline. And if you happen to be one of these, I do want to say this. You can't do better than to use Orange American Gas. It's made in the same great refinery that gives you the famous Amoco gas. Orange American is an all-petroleum product that sells at regular gas price. It gets all of its quality from the petroleum itself. It's a pure, sweet product that's free from impurities and harmful ingredients. And so, if you're a user of regular-priced gasoline, I ask you to stop at an Orange American pump. It may not be extravagant to say that the salvation of beautiful Paris may depend on the Eiffel Tower. The French have converted that lofty steel spire into a listening post. An instrument related to the microphone, but even more sensitive, will be alert every minute, night and day, to catch afar off the first vibrations of enemy airplanes. From miles away, so we're told, the betraying vibrations will be caught. Instantly, the alarm will be sped to squadrons defending planes on guard all around La Belle Paris. Up they'll soar to meet the raiders before the raiders can come over the city. There's a curious story about the 1,000-foot tower which old Gustave Eiffel built, and that is that the French have a death ray apparatus secreted there, a fearful weapon which operated from that great height, according to this story, would destroy an air or land enemy. You can hear a lot of queer yarns over there about La Tour Eiffel. 6 different Parisian taxicab drivers have cheerfully rattled off to me 6 different fables about it. The one, and it may be true at that, about the secret room in the tower, which has never been opened since the day that Gustave Eiffel died in 1923 at the age of 91. After his death, the key was taken to the Department of the Interior. The story is that Monsieur Eiffel kept in that room a mummy, which he'd obtained in Egypt and which was preserved by a lost process changeless through the centuries. Egyptian priests had told Eiffel that the mummy would confer eternity on any structure which continued to shelter it. And Eiffel always said that his tower would stand 1,000 years at least. It was the 8th wonder of the world when Gustave Eiffel built it 50 years ago. And then Al Smith came along and topped it with the 9th wonder, the fabulous Empire State Building. The tower that watches over Paris, and the Germans tried their best to plug it in the last war, is not really 1,000 feet tall. It's 983 feet on a cool day and 984 feet on a hot day. It weighs 7,700 tons. It sways like a Cecil DeMille siren, but never tips. Now, why was it built? As an exercise in pure mathematics by a great mathematician, Eiffel played with great steel girders as delicately and fastidiously as Fritz Kreisler employs the bow of his violin. La Tour Eiffel may see wondrous sights, terrible sights, in this struggle to save what's decent and humane in civilization. For in those ringing, sweeping words of the battle hymn of the Republic, he is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. But it's also written in that stirring anthem, his truth is marching on. I thank you.
One moment, please. This is David Ross, and here is an important announcement. Beginning next Monday, Edwin C. Hill will be heard on the station to which you are now listening at 5 minutes past 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Now, I'll repeat that. Beginning next Monday, Edwin C. Hill will be heard 5 nights a week at 5 minutes past 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The American Oil Company invites you to listen to Edwin C. Hill again tomorrow at our regular time, 5 minutes past 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
10:15. There are several so-called Bohemian beers, but there is only one National Bohemian, and it's the most expensive 10-cent beer your dealer can buy. The National Brewery gets more money for its beer, and it gives more real value back. Don't forget, National Bohemian is the most expensive 10-cent beer in your dealer's stock. This is WJSV, Washington. Interlude, music transcribed in the tempo of the day, arrives on time. Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, it's Freddie Monroe and his orchestra, whose opening selection is Ring Dem Bell Tones. Is important news for every radio listener. Starting on Sunday, September 24th, this station will present every night at 11 o'clock, except Saturday, Paul Sullivan, the famous news commentator. Mr. Sullivan has been making special broadcasts to America from the war zones of Europe for the Columbia Broadcasting System and will return to start his new program on September the 24th. He will bring his fresh impressions of the war-torn European scene. And with this as a background, he will interpret for you the news of the day. Mr. Sullivan has been voted one of the five most popular commentators in America for the past 3 years. Using the reports of the United Press and the complete facilities of the Columbia Broadcasting System, he will bring you a complete news summary every night, except Saturday. So remember, tune in Paul Sullivan on this station starting Sunday at 11 o'clock. See you soon with Sullivan. Marion. Marion Forbes takes the spotlight now in the vocals to The Lamp Is Low. Freddie Monroe himself would now have words with you. A little expression of his own called "Tain't What You Do, It's the Way That You Do It."
Swing may go, but here's one thing that you should know.
Think what you do.
It's the way that you do it.
Think what you do.
It's the way that you do it.
Think what you do.
It's the way that you do it.
That's what gets results. Think what you do.
It's the time you do it.
Think what you do.
It's the time you do it.
Think what you do.
All the time that you do it.
That's what gets results.
If you try hard, don't mean a thing.
Don't mean a thing.
Take it easy, then your jive will swing. It's the place that you do it. It's the time that you do it. Oh, the way that you do it, that's what gets results. Now, speaking of bands, either sweet or swing, find the song is not always a thing. Bands may come and bands may go, but here's one thing that you should know. It ain't what they play, it's the way that they play it. Now Lombardo plays like this. No, it ain't what he plays, just the way that he plays it.
That's what gets results.
And old Tommy Dorsey, he plays his music like this. just the way that he plays it.
That's what Geoffrey's all
about. Now, there's old Kay Kaiser, who has a great band, and when it comes to music, is Kay's brand. Just the way that he plays it.
That's what gets results.
Now, we'd like to join the bandwagon and go along with them, presenting our style called Bell Tone Rhythm.
Prices on imported goods are going up. Furs, for example. Insurance rates for transporting furs from Central Europe have jumped 3,000%. Imagine the effect on fur prices. Zlotnik the Furrier prepared. Months ago, Mr. Zlotnik bought heavily of the choicest imported fur pelts. And now these gorgeous furs are available at Zlotnik's at original price levels. If you mean to buy a new fur coat, be forewarned by this good advice from Zlotnik the Furrier. Now is the time to buy your furs. Gorgeous furs. Original prices. At Zlotnik's. Individual terms may be arranged. Zlotnik the Furrier, at the sign of the Big White Bear, 12th and G. Streamline interlude, music transcribed in the tempo of the day, leaves on time to return on its next run tomorrow at the same hour. Your announcer, Hugh Conover. This is Columbia Station for the nation's capital. It's 10:30 p.m. BULOVA, Bulova Watch Time. Bulova presents The President, a distinguished watch with the famous 21 jewel movement. In all the charm and color of natural gold, curved to fit your wrist. The Bull of a President is a magnificent example of rich simplicity. Exceptionally priced. WJSV, Washington.
The Midweek Review. The Columbia Broadcasting System presents its Washington news analyst, Albert Warner, to report and review the highlights in the news from the nation's capital. Here is Mr. Warner.
The president has spoken. The isolationists in the Senate have responded. They say no, and they say it loudly. The battle is on. Neither the president's argument nor the restraint which characterized his speech converted or restrained his opposition in the Senate. They met together before he addressed the opening of the special session of Congress today. They met after it. They were not changed. National unity may be the slogan of the president and also of his opponents, but a bitter clash to determine on what course we shall be unified became inevitable tonight. As you know, the president pleaded with Congress to repeal the arms embargo, which now prevents the shipment of arms to belligerent countries. On that point, he said, go back to international law, which bans no trade. Then he suggested either legislative or executive action to lessen the possibility of international incidents. He showed his willingness to accept the cash and carry plan, by which warring nations would have to put up cash for all goods they buy here and carry them away in their own ships. For the president also voiced approval of the creation of a danger zone into which American vessels would not be permitted to go. Mr. Roosevelt further proposed continuation of the ban on American travel in belligerent vessels and of war loans to the fighting countries. And again, Mr. Roosevelt stressed the objective of keeping America out of war. Let no group assume the exclusive label of the peace bloc. We all belong to it, said the president. But the essence of his program, the milk of the coconut, as Senator Bob La Follette described it, was the repeal of the arms embargo. On that issue, the fight is made, the challenge accepted. The conflict outside the halls of Congress reached into the Capitol today to touch the struggle there. 300 men and women with American flags massed in the rotunda of the Capitol. They shouted as senators walked by to the joint session, keep us out of war, no blood money, don't repeal the arms embargo. They represented the Philadelphia Committee for Defense of Constitutional Rights. One group had trouble getting into the Capitol. Representative Patrick tried to find out what the matter was. Who are you? Said one woman visitor. Are you a communist? You look like one. Patrick said he was just a congressman. Then another woman shouted, why should our boys be sent to war? This afternoon, as soon as the joint session of Congress was adjourned, the opposition in the Senate held its second organizational meeting. The number of conferees increased in the afternoon. There were altogether 24 different senators, Democrats, Republicans, two former laborites, and one progressive enlisted in the fight against repeal of the arms embargo. Seven more senators, unable to attend today, raised their number to 31. The lineup tonight stood as follows. 47 senators in favor of the president's entire program, 31 opposed, 18 doubtful. The isolationists think they are within striking distance of a block of 40 senators. In any case, 33 are enough to block cloture. It takes two-thirds of the Senate to limit debate. The opposition is now assured of sufficient strength to prevent any such move. There was no threat of filibuster. In fact, the opposition is anxious to deny any such intent. Just full, a thorough, complete discussion, all the facts, all the history, perhaps all the incidents which led to American involvement in the World War in 1917. That's all they want. But by the time the fight is completed, the friends of the administration may be saying that the difference between filibustering and free discussion is mighty hard to define. So determined was the group of isolationists which met today that it was decided to set up a permanent organization. A strategy board of five members may be named, including perhaps men outside the Senate. speeches will be made throughout the country. Veterans of the World War may be enlisted for the oratorical battle. There was even discussion of a publicity set up for the oppositionists. And although secrecy was preserved over some of the plans, word leaked out that one of the wealthiest men in the country, a well-known figure, had sent word through one of the senators that he was prepared to finance expenditures for organization on a nationwide basis. The meeting of this Senate Battalion of Death was held in the catacombs of the Capitol. Down in that unique room in the basement occupied by the veteran Senator Hiram Johnson, the California Republican. Today, Senator Johnson tossed 5 or 10 years off his age, flourished his yellow cigar holder, and with fire in his eyes, presided at the latest rally of the isolationists. When at last his conference broke up, he looked around fondly at his table and desk and the other furnishings of his office and told us newsmen it was right in this room that the fate of the League of Nations was decided. Another League of Nations fight, and two veterans of that fateful struggle here to lead the latest battle, Johnson and Borah. Of course, some people say that it was the defeat of the League which helped to bring on the international anarchy which has resulted in the latest war in Europe. But others will tell you that the Senate decision on the League kept the United States out of a series of controversies, and that the fight against the arms embargo is a continuing part of this struggle to keep this nation out of involvement abroad. Johnson and Borah are joined by the son of another isolationist of World War days, young Bob La Follette, and by the grandson of a leader in the fight against the League of Nations. Young Senator Lodge of Massachusetts took a hand in the organization work today. The fight has split parties and smashed all previous alignments. Most of the conservative Democrats have gone back to the president, energetically supporting his program for repeal of the embargo. But now, the so-called left-wingers are against the president, the progressive La Follette, the farmer laborites, Lundeen and Shipstead of Minnesota, the agrarian progressives like Frazier and Nye of North Dakota, Democratic Wheeler of Montana. Once the running mate of the elder La Follette is in the opposition also. The isolationist group includes the following Democrats: Clark of Missouri and Clark of Idaho, McCarran, Bulow, Walsh, Holt, Overton, and Downey. Those last two were rather surprising. Overton of Louisiana has usually been with the administration. That's been the position also of Downey of California, apostle of bigger and better old age pensions. George Creel, a Democratic leader of California, the official information chief during the World War, recently visited the White House. He came out wholeheartedly for repeal of the embargo and said there were no isolationists left in the West. It seems that there are at least two, and they have votes. The two senators from his own state, Downey and Johnson, are ranged against the president. Republicans at the isolationist meeting today included Vandenberg, Barber, Gurney, Kappa, Toby, Danaher, Reed, and Bridges, besides those already mentioned. Old alliances have been broken overnight. Again and again, the president has consulted Senator La Follette. This is the first really major issue on which they have split. As he left the isolationist meeting, La Follette said, "The embargo repeal is the issue, and we are absolutely opposed to it. I am convinced this fight can be won. I am satisfied public opinion is with us. The administration," he said, "has been painting its picture of success in much too rosy hue." From the Atlantic to the Pacific, every senator is being swamped by mail. Most of it is against repeal of the embargo, he said. And La Follette added that 96% of his mail was against changing the embargo. It seemed to come from every people in every walk of life. If it was propaganda, he said, he had never seen anything just like it before. Now that huge mail, by the way, is a very real factor in this fight. Many congressmen say it does not represent the sentiment in their districts. But whether it comes from the spur of one or two organizations remains to be seen. The isolationists had no particular criticism of the cash and carry plan. On the contrary, they like it. But they don't want it as a substitute for the arms embargo. for they argue that the repeal of the embargo would be showing favoritism to one side. They mean Britain and France. It would make the United States an arsenal and build up a commercial interest leading toward involvement, so they argue. Senator Vandenberg said, "I continue to disagree that the president recommends the safer non-involvement formula. So far as general international law is concerned, that's the precise code that got us into the last war." That's the oppositionist side. The administration forces also are organized, and they roll toward the battle with as much speed and with more immediate strength. The president counts definitely upon the support of the House, which will await Senate action. And in the Senate, by the admission of even the isolationists, the administration starts with the upper hand. The bulk of the Democrats remain behind the president in his appeal for ending the arms embargo. A group of Republicans has also bolted to the administration position. While the isolationists were meeting in Senator Johnson's office, high administration strategy was mapped at the White House. The Senate Majority Leader, Mr. Barkley, big, broad-shouldered Minton of Indiana, the Democratic whip, and shrewd Senator Burns of South Carolina, the big three of the administration's Senate Strategy Board, conferred with the president. Senator Barkley said later, "We have decided to take the House neutrality bill as a basis for legislation because that is in the interest of speed." The senator said he is calling a meeting of the Democratic Steering and Policy Committee for tomorrow morning to discuss legislative procedure. Effort would be made to follow the president's proposal and limit the session to neutrality, said Barkley. "Practically all the opinion that came to me today is in favor of thus limiting the session," he declared. And while the president lost Senator La Follette, he welcomed back to his ranks the Democratic conservatives, even some of those senators who have been on the suspect list as economic Tories. It was that unreconstructed rebel, Carter Glass of Virginia, who swept his colleagues at the last session into a violent rebuff of the White House for the appointment of a federal judge obnoxious to the senator. And on many issues, Senator Glass, drawling out barbed words from the corner of his mouth, has castigated New Deal policies. But this afternoon, he was at the White House, and of the president's message, he said, "It was fine, pungent, and conclusive to my point of view, and I don't see how anybody can take any other point of view." Senator George of Georgia, who was on the president's purge list in the primary a year ago, made no commitment, but he called Mr. Roosevelt's address a very strong plea. Senator Byrd of Virginia has opposed most of the major policies of the administration, yet he said today that the president's plan was admirably presented. "The strictest sort of cash-and-carry policy, vigorously enforced, is, I think, our best safeguard," Senator Byrd declared. He was taken to mean that he would accept repeal of the arms embargo if the cash-and-carry policy were extended to all belligerent purchases in the United States. The president also drove a wedge into the Republicans. He took with him Senator Taft of Ohio, who is an outstanding candidate for the Republican presidential nomination. He had the support also of the assistant Republican leader of the Senate, Mr. Austin. Colonel Knox, who ran for vice president on the Republican ticket in 1936, said, "I thought it was one of the greatest speeches Roosevelt ever made in his whole career. I thoroughly approve of his proposals." And while the president lost the progressives and former laborites in the Senate, he kept the support of the ultra-New Dealers. Senator Lee of Oklahoma said, "It was a magnificent appeal from the heart of a great patriot." The administration's strategy is to make this a lightning war, no bombs and destruction, but speed and precision. The administration counts upon a majority now in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. That seems to be a safe reckoning. Hearings will not be allowed. That's on the premise everyone knows the issue and the argument. The strategy of the opposition is the long pull. Identify repeal of the arms embargo with war involvement and play on that theme throughout the country. National unity, yes, but a legislative battle royal before it is achieved. Yet, that is in accord with the democratic process, a process blacked out in so many other countries.
Albert Warner, CBS News analyst, has presented the Midweek Review, a report, and a review of the highlights in the news from the nation's capital. Next Thursday at this same time, 10:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, WJSV will again present Albert Warner. This is Columbia Station for the nation's capital.
$10.45. Whether you spend a dime or a dollar, you want the most for your money. You get just that when you order National Bohemian Beer, the most expensive 10-cent beer your dealer can buy. It is sold by quality-minded dealers who are proud that National Bohemian, the most expensive 10-cent beer they can buy, is on their shelves. WJSV, Washington. This afternoon, the President of the United States addressed the opening session of Congress. Because of the importance of the occasion, a transcription of the address was made this afternoon and is presented at this time. President Roosevelt was presented by the Speaker of the House of Representatives, William B. Bankhead.
I have the distinguished honor of presenting the President of the United States.
Mr. President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate and the House of Representatives, I have asked the Congress to reassemble in extraordinary session in order that it may consider and act on the amendment of certain legislation, which in my best judgment so alters the historic foreign policy of the United States that it impairs the peaceful relations of the United States with foreign nations. At the outset, I proceed on the assumption that every member of the Senate and of the House of Representatives and every member of the executive branch of the government, including the President and his associates, personally and officially, are equally and without reservation in favor of such measures as will protect the neutrality, the safety, and the integrity of our country, and at the same time, keep us out of war. Because I am wholly willing to ascribe an honorable desire for peace to those who hold different views from my own as to what those measures should be, I trust that these gentlemen will be sufficiently generous to ascribe equally lofty purposes to those with whom they disagree. Let no man or group in any walk of life assume exclusive protectorate over the future well-being of America, because I conceive that regardless of party or section, the mantle of peace, the mantle of patriotism, is wide enough to cover us all. Let no group assume the exclusive label of the peace bloc. We all belong to it. I have at all times kept the Congress and the American people informed of events and trends in foreign affairs. I now review them in a spirit of understatement. Since 1931, the use of force instead of the council table has constantly increased in disputes between nations, except in the Western Hemisphere, where in all those years there has been only one war, now happily terminated. During those years also, the building up of vast armies and navies and storehouses of war has proceeded abroad with growing speed and intensity. But during these years, and extending back even to the days of the Kellogg-Briand Pact, the United States has constantly, consistently, and conscientiously done all in its power to encourage peaceful settlements, to bring about reduction of armaments, and to avert threatened wars. We have done this not only because any war anywhere necessarily hurts American security and American prosperity, but because of the more important fact that any war anywhere retards the progress of morality and religion and impairs the security of civilization itself. For many years, the primary purpose of our foreign policy has been that this nation and this government should strive to the utmost to aid in avoiding war among nations. But if and when war unhappily comes, the government and the nation must exert every possible effort to avoid being drawn in to the war. The executive branch of the government did its utmost within our traditional policy of non-involvement to aid in averting the present appalling war. Having thus driven and failed, this government must lose no time or effort to keep our nation from being drawn in. In my candid judgment, we shall succeed in those efforts. We are proud of the historical record of the United States and of all the Americas during all these years because we have thrown every ounce of our influence for peace into the scale of peace. I note in passing what you will all remember, the long debates of the past on the subject of what constitutes aggression, on the methods of determining who the aggressor might be, and on who the aggressor in past wars had been. Academically, this may have been instructive, as it may have been of interest to historians to discuss the pros and the cons and the rights of the wrong and wrongs of the World War during the decade that followed it. But in the light of problems of today, problems of tomorrow, responsibility for acts of aggression is not conceived, and the writing of the record can safely be left to future historians. There has been sufficient realism in the United States to see how close to our own shores came dangerous paths which were being followed on other continents. Last January, I told the Congress that a war which threatened to envelop the world in flames has been averted. But it has become increasingly clear that peace is not assured. By April last, new tensions had developed. A new crisis was in the making. Several nations with whom we had had friendly, diplomatic, and commercial relations had lost or were in the process of losing their independent identity and their very sovereignty. During the spring and summer, the trend was definitely toward further acts of military conquest and away from peace. As late as the end of July, I spoke to members of the Congress about the definite possibility of war. I should have called it the probability of war. And last January also, I spoke to this Congress of the need for further warning of new threats of conquest, military and economic, a challenge to religion, to democracy, and to international good faith. I said an ordering of society which relegates religion, democracy, and good faith among nations to the background can find no place within it for the ideals of the Prince of Peace. The United States rejects such an ordering and retains its ancient faith. And I said, we know what might happen to us of the United States if the philosophies of force were to encompass the other continents and invade our own. We, no more than other nations, can afford to be surrounded by the enemies of our faith and our humanity. Fortunate it is, therefore, that in this Western Hemisphere, we have under a common ideal of democratic government a rich diversity of resources and of peoples functioning together in mutual respect and peace. And last January, in the same message, I also said, we have learned that when we deliberately try to legislate neutrality, our neutrality laws may operate unevenly and unfairly, may actually give aid to an aggressor and deny it to the victim. The instinct of self-preservation should warn us that we ought not to let that happen anymore. And it was because of what I foresaw last January from watching the trend of foreign affairs and their probable effect upon us that I recommended to the Congress in July of this year that changes be enacted in our neutrality law. The essentials for American peace in this war-torn world, have not changed since last January or last July. And that is why I ask you again to re-examine our own legislation. Go back a little. Beginning with the foundation of our constitutional government in the year 1789, the American policy in respect to belligerent nations, with one notable exception, was based on international law. Be it remembered that what we call international law has always had as its primary objectives the avoidance of causes of war and the prevention of the extension of war. The single exception to which I refer was the policy adopted by this nation during the Napoleonic Wars, when, seeking to avoid involvement, we acted for some years under the so-called Embargo and Non-Intercourse Acts. That policy turned out to be a disastrous failure. First, because it brought our own nation close to ruin, and second, because it was the major cause of bringing us into active participation in European wars in our own War of 1812. And it is merely reciting history to recall to you that one of the results of the policy of embargo and non-intercourse was the burning in 1814 a part of this capital in which we are assembled today. Our next deviation, by statute, from the sound principles of neutrality and peace through international law did not come for 130 years. It was the so-called Neutrality Act of 1935, only 4 years ago, an act continued in force by the joint resolution of May 1st, 1937. despite grave doubts expressed as to its wisdom by many senators and representatives and by officials charged with the conduct of our foreign relations, including myself. I regret that the Congress passed that act. I regret equally that I signed that act. On July 14th of this year, I asked the Congress in the cause of peace and in the interest of real American neutrality and security to take action to change that act. I now ask again that such action be taken in respect to that part of the act which is wholly inconsistent with ancient precepts of the laws of nations, the embargo provisions. I ask it because they are, in my opinion, most vitally dangerous to American neutrality, American security, and above all, American peace.